Hello, this is Cameron McCune and Bob Dobbs, and this is session number 40 being recorded on November 4th, 2021. I'm going to lower my volume to get less echo. Hello? Yeah, it's still there, but hopefully you don't hear it too much, do you, Cameron?
No, not too much.
Okay. We're looking at my book, All About Donald Trump, and we've gone to page 77 on my layout. Is it 77 for you, Cameron?
Well, I have a 77, but I don't know what you're
right
pointing to. So,
you scan down to the darkened part, not the blue, not the casual oral talk. And I say,
abrasive confrontational aspects of tactility?
Yeah. Meanwhile, the abrasive confrontational aspects of tactility surfed over the old discarnate merged interrupting surfaces. This evoked the dominance of the neoconservative liberal meme or preference in the global membrane of the last 35 years. Not knowing this aspect of McLuhan's tactility led to a discounting of McLuhan's relevance on a theoretical level for educational purposes. So then,
why don't you tease that apart?
What the heck do I mean?
Much of that.
Yeah. Okay. So McLuhan defined tactility as contrast or brutal encounter, not brutal, brusque. Brusque interface.
Sure.
It's not
tactility. Could be anything. Right, because tactility is the engine, you could say, of the genesis of all things.
Oh, wait, you're fading out. You suddenly went to real quiet.
Oh, sorry. Anyway, tactility is the secret generator of all things. So, yes, it can be abrasive and confrontational, or it can be merging. Interrupting, what I don't understand in your description here is how you're contrasting these things.
Well, I don't give any examples. I trust
That's
the words
right.
do enough. But you just said it. The brusque interfacing is the abrasive confrontational, but tactility is not one thing or the other, so you have to include what people think is flow. Some people think tactility is very sensitive, touchy-feely stuff. And you get into the zone or you flow, and you don't have any interruptions. But that'll get you in trouble because you will be interrupted. So you have to expect the interruption and not idealize tactility as emerged floating. You must include the abrasive confrontational. So that's how you know something. If you're just all in the flow, you eventually lose awareness of that. So then you got to get your toe chopped off, and then you'll wake up, oh, there's another state, a painful state that's different from what I was in. I wish I was back in the non-painful state. So that's how we know. Tactility helps us know. It's probably the very drama of knowing. I use the word contrast. You got to have contrast to know. So that's what I'm trying to do there. Merge versus non-merging. Now, you should understand that, right?
Absolutely. I understand and agree with it. That's
very
more
good.
Or less exactly what McLuhan is about.
Okay. So I said, this evoked the dominance of the neoconservative liberal meme preference in the global membrane of the last 35 years. What the heck? The dominance of the new... I don't know what I mean by neoconservative liberal meme, other than they tended towards the merged. Oh, yeah, so that would be globalism. They tended toward the merge, and they didn't foresee bitterness or resentment to the first world, McLuhan called it, taking over the planet, and everybody subsumed or subservient to it. But then that confrontational, abrasive tribalism or nationalism, whatever you want to call it, symbolized by Trump, showed up. And that set the neoconservative people out of whack. They didn't know how to handle that. So I think that's what I mean, that the bias, and I should say that in there, the bias was for the discount of merged surfaces, not the confrontational.
Right.
So everywhere they went, they caused confrontation, but they, quote, suppressed it or ignored it and just kept building their the global membrane, or what I would call the Android meme. So we need to go into what the difference is between the global membrane and the Android meme. On the surface, no difference. But then you have to go into the differences. So what do I say? I'm looking at the blue part.
Yep.
To see what I say to explain.
Well, you're just talking about the misinterpretation of McLuhan as some sort of romantic guy that was predicting Shangri-La through television.
Right. Okay. Where is this? I went back too far. But maybe this is good to point out. So this is page 72. I go, let's look at this discarnate phenomenon as it actually is today. McLuhan was describing the actual possession of the Earth's populations by an electrified climate that, for all intents and purposes, drowned the chemical body, and Gutenbergian arts and scientists with a new invisible matter, or physics in quotes. The radio and TV environments, bioelectricity in the global theater, in the global village, were tactile in themselves, extensions of the merging slash blocking or coherence aspect of tactility. Another aspect of tactility is that it reduces your information input to a coherence or some semblance of organized mind, or Western people say rationality. And if that breaks down, then people lose themselves and they can't get coherent again. Leads to all kinds of, you know, mental discomfort. Then I said, but tactility has an abrasive hard edge aspect. See Edmund Carpenter's They Became What They Beheld, 1970. According to McLuhan, tactility is the interplay of the merging and abruptly interrupting tendencies, not a hard and fast sense or object. It's not a hard or fast sense or object, and it's asymptotically. So I'm thinking my definition is actually pretty good, and I'm scrolling down to what I first read, where I say the abrasive... well, I'll just read this part first.
Are you going back to 78? Or
No, I'm at 74. I'm going down. I was at 73 and 72. Now I'm down at 74. And I say, once there were computer and satellite environments, the interplay of radio, TV, computer, and satellite effects created a tactile interplay among these different media, a vaster and deeper extension of tactility in the global theater. In other words, you had a radio environment, that was tactile. You had a TV environment. Well, when you had all these other environments, computer and satellite, that's a larger, bigger than the global village, or more imploded, or more tactile, you know, abrupt, multi-level interfacing. So we call that the global theater. The pastoral tactility of radio and TV technologies themselves was well developed in the first explorations articles by McLuhan in the 50s. So you can read what I say about that, though. That's a good statement. And then I'm starting to talk about the put-on of power. So I have a quote from Take Today. Put on the whole world as your mask of power, says the electro-technical switch. It gives you the opportunity to put on the whole world or all its media contents. And, of course, that's a prediction before the Internet. That's in 72. So that's describing the Internet or social media. So that's pretty good. Then I say James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake anticipated the tactile, in brackets, unity interplaying with fragmentation, or the analog global theater of the 60s as spelled out by McLuhan. But the seemingly more violent media landscapes of the late 60s and early 70s, which was totally understandable if you included tactility in the interplay of satellite, computer, and TV and radio, right? If you're still thinking the global village and just radio environment and not noticing the new environments, you rapidly became inefficient, ineffectual, and lost in nostalgia. But the seemingly more violent media landscapes of the late 60s and early 70s that commentators thought contradicted McLuhan's projections, they carried on and completed, and he developed his projections, including the more violent situation. And, you know, right in 68, he makes a whole theme in War and Peace in the Global Village about violence as an identity crisis, and that's the year that news agencies had video transmitted by satellite. So it changed news programs. You could be more right there, getting footage right away. So that's the global theater, 68. So these were fulfilling McLuhan's actual projections. So you go to his Dewline articles from 68 to 1970 and take today. And these writings in the late 60s, early 70s. McLuhan saw the squaring of the extended tactility of TV in the interplay of massive electronic environments. So I'm trying to express a deeper, more complex tactility. So I just came up with we squared the global village of the 50s. You follow that?
Yeah.
Okay. And in my oral commentary, I say the interplay of the global theater environments is the squaring of the particular tactility in the TV screen. And that helps people understand tactility a little more. It's a 50s moment to say TV is tactile. The global theater has all these environments interplaying and interfering. That's a different level of tactility, but it's still tactility. Now, that is something not said by anybody, and it's a very important point to understand the later McLuhan, the post-understanding media. The McLuhan who says that cliched archetype, that book, is a great leap forward from understanding media. Do you know what I mean? You agree with that?
Well, I certainly agree that starting already in the late 1950s, McLuhan was saying that in order to understand the medium, you have to understand media. And what you're saying here is that in order to understand tactility, you have to understand tactilities.
So that's, I tell you squared.
Yeah. Well, I'm using, tactility squared is one way of talking about tactility as a natural plural. So what we're agreeing that in order to understand media, in order to understand tactility, you have to understand the range over which they extend.
Yeah, and the reason I make the tactility squared, I'm on the way to getting to technology coming alive as the Android meme. It's separating itself from TV tactility.
Right. But when I hear you say, technology coming alive, I can see some people understanding that in terms of some sort of horror movie.
Yeah.
HAL.
Or They Live. Did you ever see They Live? The guy with the sunglasses?
No.
Who could?
No.
They Live sometime in the late 80s, early 90s. It's a good thing. The guy discovers sunglasses, and then so he can see subliminal advertising in billboards that the average citizen can't see, but you get this magic glasses on, you can see it's juvenile in terms of subliminal projecting,
right.
But you are seeing something going on with some special thing that the media managers are the only ones aware of.
Right, so, right. But the point I'm trying to make here is that the, when you talk about the media environment becoming alive, I think what you're saying is that the notion of what being alive is needs to be rethought.
Well, so what I would do is I would quote two or three quotes from 68. He had a couple of them in War and Peace and Gold Village. He talked about people have to realize it is an organic electric environment, or the electric environments are organic. That was his term for alive. And then he talks about, he has another version of that in the Playboy interview. So I show that he's saying something about it that's different from what people, you know, suspect. And then so I say, that's what I mean by live. You could just use McLuhan's words rather than mine to get across the point. But yeah. Now people said in the biographies and that McLuhan seemed to get depressed in the 70s and down and pissed off that the utopian so-called visions he had didn't happen. It's so ridiculous. And when you read his or heard his talk in the 70s, talking about this more complex tactility, and he couldn't even tell what the difference was between the medium and the message, which you found he even felt that back in the late 50s, but he didn't highlight that too much, but he did in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
If you get to what I'm talking about, and what I see what he's doing in the 70s, he's a very interesting person and thinker and ahead of everybody still. And that's shown in Take Today, not in The City's Classroom or The Laws of Media, but Take Today with Barry's help. There's something going on that includes the cliched archetype, and I guess it gets to the tetrad, but the tetrad, it looks like more reductionism for a very incredibly complex situation, and explains the confusion of the 70s, the increasing terrorism and outright indecency by people on all levels. You know what I mean? And it gets worse in the 80s and 90s. And McLuhan was totally accurate about that. He saw that coming. And so I don't see any McLuhan people. Maybe you do, but you tend to talk more about words. Do you say what I'm saying in any form?
Well, I stay away from diachronic or, you know, historical analysis.
Right.
Because I'm distrustful of that with McLuhan, or at least it's, you know, it may be that my take on McLuhan is a little bit one-sided and your take is a little bit one-sided the other way.
Yep, I agree.
But
I think they're both important. We've carved out separate complementary developments of doing justice to what McLuhan was getting at.
Correct.
Yeah, well, that's good to say it that way.
And it's not only around words like live and alive.
And organic.
Where you can see those differences. Another is that your analysis, in my view, is interesting in that you take up McLuhan's notion of languages being the sort of the individualities of our time. Not individual people, but the
right.
collective environment that they're caught up in without knowing it.
Yes.
And you do a better job of talking about that than I do, I believe.
Okay, I agree. I don't know if I agree, but I'll accept that because I do. I have specialized in that. I know how to respond to people's different subjective not getting it, and I have a way of talking around it to help them see it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I agree with that.
Yeah. And then you do it's almost conceptual, trying to show percept conceptually and showing there's, in a way, you would say, no difference. But you just demand close reading more than I do. So I'm like showing a movie and you're showing a medieval manuscript in Greek or something.
Maybe. My point is that McLuhan is much deeper than he's taken to be, and that depth leads us in good directions.
Yeah.
What you do is you say that McLuhan is a great kind of movie director.
Yeah.
And he's interesting because of these scenes that he shows sort of as they go along in historical time.
Yeah, I call him a satellite conductor. And
there you go.
He found a way to think big. Bucky Fuller said, think big. Well, he didn't think as big as McLuhan. And people need to be stretched by think biggers or big thinkers. He came up with a very great big thinking scenario. Like he says in Playboy, you know, we take a computer and we modulate environments around the planet. And economics is already doing that on a puny scale. That's a big thought. And if you get too practical, you say, well, that's never going to happen. I'm not going to think about it. But he did help you stretch if you considered what he was pointing out, because it was kind of happening anyways, you know, clumsily by the corporate elite. They were managing global environments all the time and doing a very bad, hiding the fact they were doing it. They were scared.
That's a very good way of putting it. It's like some people are short-sighted, some people are far-sighted, and McLuhan was sort of megalo-sighted.
Yeah.
Where he could see a big picture where other people not only didn't see anything, but didn't even try to see anything.
Right, and so that's why the globalist versus nationalist argument is so puny, because people's vision of globalism is at best 1920s or something, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's a physical imperialism or something.
Right, so then I would come up with terms like solar government. That's what we're dealing with. And it's actually called echelon. You know, that's the agreement among New Zealand, in Britain, the United States, Australia, I think, and one other country, Canada, maybe.
Yes.
You know about echelon.
Thank you, country up north.
Yeah, that is solar government, not world government. And that gets to the global membrane. The solar government is not outer space. It's a more extreme version of your interior landscape. It's a resonating node with no visual marker points, which is tactilely squared.
Mm-hmm.
So I've said this so much for decades, it's all obvious to me, but it does takes a while for people to catch up to me on it, on the point. They have to listen for a while.
So you see the vibrating membrane as a singular or as a plurality of membranes that are competing and cooperating with one another on different levels.
Yeah, if it's tactility, then it has to be both.
Right.
It has to be both, always. You know, both and is a good statement. Not either or, both and is capitalized, it's or italicized, you know. It's extra from even the both. That's why yin-yang symbols are not any good. So the embracing of these icons of Eastern religions, which people find a little more complementary than the literate West black and white Christian ideas, that's nowhere near what we need to perceive. So no religions or icons have come up with the imagery we need for our time. And so that's why I point to Finnegan's Wake. That's the closest picture of what we're dealing with way back 40, 50 years ago. Now, the tech body is that's a whole new thing. So we're trying to get to there. But you got to go through this global theater, solar theater. You got to update your percepts on this. And you should be then fascinated that, wow, I can understand McLuhan. I can see that he's doing what Bob's talking about. And then you start to read McLuhan, and you'll enjoy it. You'll find it a great poetry. And it's, quote, accurate, you know? And it's way beyond what Kissinger and the Triggermen limit the conversation to.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Okay, so I said different level of tactility. Then I said later McLuhan in the late 70s accurately foresaw the flipping of this leviathan of tactile mixed corporate media which I've just been describing, the huge part, the solar government part, into an environment of new autonomy for the already discarnate super angel. And I always remember McLuhan saying once or twice in the Monday night seminars that mass man was not tribal. There was an increasing autonomy factor in the life of people with the mixed corporate media environment, which people didn't know really how to translate that back into social values. They just became more anarchistic in their lifestyles. Nobody was watching them anymore. No more tyranny of the tribal oral space. You know, tribal people, you know, you're in a tribe, man, you got to watch yourself. You can't be, you know, jerking off and going off and running off amok from the tribe, which you can do technologically once you had cable TV and then early internet. You follow that?
Yep. Yeah, but not, I mean, it's not because, at that point, it's not because it's not because the technology is enabling or disabling something at a personal level. It's because the technology is disabling the old tribalisms.
Yeah.
And those old tribalisms were built into people so that their whole identity was caught up in it. And when the tribe became dismantled by the media, then that had the effect of also disabling the tribal identity within.
Yeah. What was I going to say about that? That's why it's really sad to see appraisals, even maybe in McLuhan, in university curricula, or what do they call it? What's it called? The prospectus or something, when they describe the course. What's that called?
Mm-hmm.
The
yeah.
curriculum. And they just talk about, well, he saw tribal values coming back, and we were going tribal. That's so stupid. In terms of what he's really doing. So McLuhan never gets a fair hearing on the level we're talking about right now.
No, for sure not.
Yeah.
And that's because a lot of the stuff that he was talking about was simply invisible until fairly recently.
Yeah.
And now it's just starting to sort of come into people's vision.
Yeah.
So I think McLuhan is on the upswing.
Yeah.
I think he'll be studied a lot more in the future than he has been in the past.
Yeah, especially if they listen to us. We'll point out what no one else is pointing out about the value of McLuhan and why he's a good guide to the 21st century, even though he was describing what was going on in the 60s and 70s.
Right. But he said if you pay attention to the present, you are seeing the future.
Yeah. So after I say this, that new autonomy for the already discarnate super angel, so the resonant node, the global membrane, are included in this. But I'm trying to go past that. You're not just a resonant node. You can disconnect from the resonant node. So in the oral part after that, I go, the explaining Leviathan, the program monstrous multi-environments. And most people felt that with stagflation and economic ups and downs and massive layoffs and, you know, the economic chaos since the 70s. That's program monstrous multi-environments that had to do that since nobody knew how to get a grip on it and get any consensus about how to make it softer or turn it off or modulate it. So we were up against program monstrous multi-environments. Starting in the 70s, and so I say the Leviathan of that is now going to flip into the more refined cloth of the individual God self. So I'm trying to show, I'm not trying to be religious, but I'm taking the idea of what people might think a God is and saying, well, the technology was putting you in a God position on the autonomy level. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Now I want to...
Yeah. That has to do with what I was just talking about with the shattering of the old tribes.
Right. The closer you come to the new situation was that you weren't limited by God self, I mean by tribal self. You had a new freedom, autonomy, and...
Or so it seemed,
Yes, yeah. Well, yeah, as long as the media was there, the environment was there, you could ride it. So I say, so I use the word God self cautiously, but then I come... Using Don Thiel, this gets me out of that. Professor Donald Thiel termed this the synesthetic versus the co-anesthetic. Now, I only saw him use the word co-anesthetic. I don't know if he made it up or if it is. I looked it up years ago. I can't remember. It might be somewheres, but it's not used very much. It's just the synesthetic. So the co-anesthetic is being the dynamics of the media merging. So it puts one in the driver's seat. So, and that's what the internet did. It took all these media, analog Gutenberg media, and put it into your Palm Pilot. So you were sitting in the middle of it. You were the driver of it. And that's co-anesthesia, not synesthesia. So you use the co-anesthetic to explain this drive towards new autonomy and putting you at the center of your media clothing. And that's your, quote, might seem like a God self. And probably the people that were stealing, they knew computers, they knew how to steal lots of money all over the place. They were stoned on their God self. They saw the superpower they had, understanding the new digital discarnate state and how they could hijack all kinds of corporate environments. They got drunk on that. And, you know, maybe Rupert Murdoch and those symbolisms, those icons of these guys that people felt we can't stop them. They just have too much access to the whole planet as a playground. So they're like gods.
Absolutely.
And people didn't see that they were getting close to that themselves, not until the internet. But... it explains the loss of identity in the 80s. People just found that, wow, this world is so much bigger than me. I'm just a little guy, because they were only thinking in chemical body terms, right? Now, if they listened to my radio show on CKLN for 2 or 3 years, where I go over and over, they'd start to see, I think, the bigger dimensions they're in, and they are potentially as big as any corporate CEO. The corporate CEOs were just propped up because of the bias of news media and Western individualism, which liked to hoik up the billiard ball Gutenberg individual. It's still happening. And they were called billionaires. You follow what I'm saying?
Sure, sure.
So that's what needed to be talked about, and that's what I did on the radio for many years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But did you talk about how those that sort of identity, if it's taken seriously, implodes?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
At the blog, I talk a lot about how the identity of the God self, as you call it, depends upon the certification of the same God self doing the nomination, right? And so it's a logic that falls through itself like a black hole.
Now, who did
God self has to certify itself.
Yeah. Now, Croker came along in the early 90s and wrote, you know, eloquently, poetically about the same situation I was talking about. And he talked about ecstasy and then crash. Steve Jobs and those guys would go through this. They'd go through some ecstatic inflation, and then they'd always crash. And it happened in the population in terms of allergies and environmental allergies and things like that. I saw a lot of it in Carolyn's practice. Because she was on the leading edge in dealing with newer problems and effects, that the medical profession wasn't keeping up on. She was an expert, so I would talk to her about it, and I could really see McLuhan's point, or what we're saying now about the God self and the inflated self, how that really wrecked the chemical body. So the population, you know, the discarnate peasants, were all collapsing anyways, ecstasy and then crash. That's why Coker came up with crash theory. He went further than Baudrillard, I would say. But yes, it was happening to the biggies too. It was happening to everybody. McLuhan said, you can't be a philosopher king and run the show. He said that in the 60s. Well, nobody's chemical body survived what we're talking about unless you got into serious self-yoga, turned yourself off, you didn't get carried away with your God self. You know what I mean? So when part of my image on CKLN was to wake up the God self and present it seriously, present that I was in charge of everything and all these scenarios to show that that's what we all were experiencing, but we never had the guts to understand it about ourselves or even tell anybody. So that was the revolution of what I was doing in developing McLuhan and Croker.
Yeah.
All right. Now, we met in 98, but you never heard me until 2009, 10, or 11 or something, right?
Well, other than the talk that you gave after the question you gave to Tom Wolfe, which I thought was excellent.
That was 99.
That would have been the first thing that I heard of you that was, not on the printed page.
Right. And you said, well, that guy kind of knows a little bit more than usually here in the McLuhan world.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm proud of what I did and proud of where I got to with it. And I'm ridiculously, satirized by the McLuhan industry. It's amazing how stupid they are. And maybe if you're a teacher, you can't let yourself catch up to what's going on. You have to stay on the stupid student level. You know what I mean? By having the job of teaching and adapting yourself to the lowly requirements of education and university, you're limiting yourself. You got a job, you can raise a family, you got a mortgage and it's paid, but it does not keep you tuned in. And I think it's hard for these people, these professors, to get away from it. I had a lot of good conversation with Zingroni about it. He struggled with it. He consciously knew it wasn't good for him to be a teacher because you had to give yourself over to your students too much. Do you know what I'm saying?
Sure. Sure.
And like you develop what you're doing, which is unique because you weren't beholden to anybody.
Correct.
So that would give you time to notice things, to newer developments, even to notice me.
Yeah. Well, if you teach, you need to have a kind of package.
Yeah.
That you present. And if you were to, instead of that, identify what's wrong with packages, what's limited about packages, then you would be trying to pass on a kind of nihilism, if you will,
yeah,
a formlessness to students. But it's not really ethical to do.
Right.
It's like formlessness as a package. And I think that kind of contradiction has increasingly become what teachers try to teach.
Yeah.
I think that's part of, what the whole controversy now is before educational boards.
Yeah.
That teachers are saying that they should have the right more than parents to say what education is. And by what is education, they generally mean, well, It means that you see that nothing is worthwhile, and, that, you know, white people are evil, and, you know, critical race theory, CRT.
Yeah, you know what they mean by white people are evil? They're talking about the chip body. And the white people are seen as the first world, they got in there first. It's not necessarily true anymore, right? Everybody in the world's got the chip body, but I bet you that's what that is. That's the horseless carriage term for the autonomy of the chip body, and they're calling it a chemical body term, identifying with the white race, because they got there first on the level of affluence. So there's a new idea. I just explained the whole fucking white supremacy delusion.
Well, I like the mythology, or the methodology, I should say, because what you're suggesting is that there are ways of understanding the interrelationship of the bodies, which can account for historical phenomena.
Right, and hysteria.
Well, I'll have to think about that a bit.
Yeah, no, that's pretty neat. I'm going to be using that one. White supremacy, misidentification of the chip body. Yeah, makes sense. All right. So this co-anesthetic versus synesthetic, had you ever read that in Thiel or knew about it? Is that new to you?
No, I haven't read much of Thiel's work, number one. And number two, I have looked up whether or not the term ever occurs in McLuhan, and I don't think it does.
No, it doesn't. But do you see it anywhere? Is it even in the dictionary?
Oh, that I don't know.
Well, you're fast. Type it in. See what you come up with. C-O-E-N. C-O-E-N-A-E.
Right. One of the problems with words like that is that they don't have a consistent spelling.
Yeah.
So
you could do O E C O E E N E without the A E. I seem to recall Don citing something, some other place that he got it from. So you don't see it anywhere, right?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of hits here, mostly from dictionaries. I see there's a Wiktionary entry for it. Lots of people are defining it, but they're not too much saying how it would be used. It seems to be used with... vision seems to be a little bit like
the panopticon. It's the idea of the director in the middle of all the media swirling around you.
Yeah, exactly. That's precisely how. I'm just glancing over hits, but that's how the hits seem to treat it.
Okay, so they've got the definition correctly.
Seems like. I don't know what correct or incorrect is, and because that's not a term that I use or that I ordinarily see. But I can see that they're using it in terms of... the coordination of bodily feeling.
Right. So you, I mean, you know, back in the day, in the 80s, the early 90s, you want to read a magazine, you had to get out in the street and buy it. Then once the internet happened, the magazine was in your lap. You didn't have to go anywhere.
Right.
So you were put in the center. It was almost like you were at the head of a corporation of Time or Newsweek, and they probably had rapid access to everything. They didn't have to go out into the they had fax machines or whatever. They had technology where they could get stuff faster and not go to have to run down to the store. We were becoming equal to that. with the internet. So that's pretty powerful to have that access compared to what people had before.
Yes, well, the problem is that it's a power that is deceptive, in that it gives you a sense of a power to begin with, but it really removes a lot of power at the same time, and you don't notice that. So it's a little bit like the God self. When that emerges out of the tribal, that seems like a liberation.
But yeah.
Then later it turns out that that's a tremendous weakness, because the tribal was giving you ground, and the God self can never do that.
Right, and you're up against all the other God selves.
Correct.
So the... So you lose. Okay, what was it? It's more of a consumerist coinesthetic. You're in the center of the storm of media, and you got lots of stuff you can consume. But the hijacking of visual space, the Gutenberg administration or Kinetic administration, the guys who meet on golf courses, they are more the producer level, and you're just stuck with consuming a lot of more stuff. You can't counter. You can't compete with certain gods, like the Murdochs say. But with Web 2.0, you got closer to that, because you could start making your own media, not just consuming. So it became producer mania in the second phase, rather than consumer mania. But you still were not in charge of a big chunk of something. You know, you, in that sense, you were deluded that you got more autonomy. But there is a level of autonomy that everybody gets to enjoy that they never had before in social organization. You know, the Howard Hughes image, you know, McLuhan was fascinated with Hughes. He was like a guy who just stayed in a hotel room, you know, for decades.
Right.
And he'd be in the co-anesthetic hyper driver's seat and, you know, could conspire against governments all over the world. Remember,
right.
he did the Glomar right. Explorer thing in the 70s,
yeah.
and it disappeared. He lost it or something. It was a problem with that big thing that he had. And, you know, he was doing it for governments, and then backfired on him. So McLuhan used to say by the mid-70s that we're in a new ball game, and we're in a ball game stadium where everybody was nobody, even the apparent leaders. So the God self flips into G20, G7 summit meetings. You have to coordinate with other gods on the leftover of hierarchy, which is propping up individual identity. You know, bureaucratic control of things comes out of the literate identity. You know, you can't be Nelson Rockefeller. You can't hijack his name. Now, on the secret level, among secret service worlds, you could do that. You could kill him and have your double be put in. That would be the wars of the gods. And that's why people started to popularize or accept the idea of conspiracy theories, because they could see that there was a lot of fighting on the God self among the producer leaders, or what McLuhan called the trigger men.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is all, I agree with what you're saying, but it's all on quite a superficial level, not what you're saying, but what you're describing remains on a very superficial level. So that McLuhan, for example, in his letters to Voeglin, he said that the essence of Gnosticism is to pretend that everything is playing out on a secular level, whereas really it's a theological level. And so what you're describing with the Battle of the Gods and the G20 and all this sort of stuff is people acting on the basis of a ground that is no longer there, and they have their positions because they're able to either ignore that or act psychopathologically in spite of having no ground.
Right. So two thoughts come to that. First of all, McLuhan says society became an art form. You know, People magazine creates this idea that there's an elite, they can afford to go to the opera, and they got their yachts and all that, and they're running huge environments. Now they're trying to go to the moon or Mars, you know, Bezos and those guys, right? They're trying to do it with private spaceships. The other thing he said was, you can either be a devil or an angel. Remember that statement?
Yes.
So the first part you were talking about, and that's what I thought of. You can either be a devil or an angel, and that's not a super angel. Everybody's a super angel, but you could fall back to being a devil and an angel, or an angel and thinking you're doing something, and that's where you had no ground, and you could get nailed at any time.
But that's something you talk about in your pamphlet, right?
Yeah.
That I mean, angel or devil is not something that is individual. People may mistake it as being individual, but really it's collectivities that are running people, not people running them.
Yeah, you put on those environments, and then you're subject to them.
Correct.
So, you know, all the old humanist ideas of freedom and collectivity or state and justice and all these things all are ridiculously nothing in these new environments.
They fall apart in an electric environment. And one of the things that was not understood at all about McLuhan, and this was part of what you brought out in your remarks to Tom Wolfe, is that McLuhan was actually a champion of the book, not because he loved, you know, the feel of paper or something like that, but because there are a lot of things that depend upon the Gutenbergian mentality, like privacy, like individual rights, which are very important things, but they cannot survive in an electric environment without understanding media.
Yeah. And you can't even be ethical. He said you can't have ethics.
Correct. Correct.
And so you can see that would explain the rise of fundamentalism in all kinds and different cultures, but people looking for virtue or trying to retrieve literate values of ethics. And they all made fools of themselves doing it.
Yeah, they're trying to. They're desperate for ground.
Yeah,
and so then
they abstracted it into ideas of virtue.
Right. The only way that they can see the establishment of ground is to find a singular virtue that can be contrasted to multiple evils.
Yeah.
And
you specialize sort of in finding a value and stick to
it. Yeah. So if a value, the whole reason that the God cell falls apart is that the identification of virtue cannot be motivated. It can't be something that you're doing because it benefits you.
Right.
But that's the only way for a God self to identify a virtue, is to do it from him or herself, because that's the God self.
And you can't do it. And no, I think
it just falls apart. It turns into a sort of a Charlie Chaplin comedy.
Right, and this is where McLuhan could be considered a saint in a couple of hundred years, eventually, by the church, if there's still a church. He wrestled. Nobody else seemed to do it. Maybe they did, but he was more populist about it and made it simple and got the question out there. But he pointed out, you can't be a Christian today. All these values we're having that we're trying to retrieve and getting fanatic about it and then becoming fundamentalists and fascists about it in the old terms. And that's a ridiculous term to describe anything about today. But he really explored, there's your cul-de-sac, he explored the problems of having those values or even having respect for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, he thought personally that he knew sort of how to answer that sort of question, but he found it very frustrating that he couldn't pass that on to his kids. And so that told him that he might have some kind of answer that he could live with himself, but it was not very persuasive.
Yeah, it couldn't be applied collectively, or become a public institution or some mm-hmm. Something that, well, that people collectively could, I don't want to say correct. Gather around, but remember, just something to remember.
Gather around is a good term.
Yeah.
Right? Because what's wanted is something that is collective, that people can believe in and be supported by, but still be individuals.
Yeah.
And so that's the goal of the new tribalism, you could say. But the problem is the new tribalism has not been able to find a ground. And so what he was saying about the Catholic Church is that the Catholic Church should make that problem its sort of central question. And he was very confident that the church could answer that question, but first it had to take that question very seriously and pose it. But instead of that, the church was going back into some sort of Gutenbergian hierarchy and Gutenbergian
yep.
symbolism and all this stuff. And, of course, all of that was going to disappear, as McLuhan saw very very clearly.
Yeah, so it's come to the point where the Vatican cannot save its image. There's still a lot of Catholics in the world, but it's amazing how many people would not want to be Catholic or have left the church because of all the unforeseen scandals and identity crises that happened in the priest life. So I don't think people foresaw such a scrambling of such long-term institutions. And you've got radical priests saying, well, the communists took over the Vatican, or the devil did, and they blame some supernatural things that are happening, or just conspiracies of trilaterals or something. It's totally inadequate to the issue. So they don't know why they're going to be dismantled. So as you talk about that, I think Wyndham Lewis comes up with the question really well, when he said in 1929, now, disregarding, if you can, whatever your political views may be. So then he bracketed and tells you his political views to get them off out of the way so he can get on to other matters. So now, disregarding, if you can, whatever your political views may be, bracket, and here's mine. Mine are partly communist and partly fascist, with a distinct streak of monarchism in my Marxism, but at bottom, anarchist with a healthy passion for order. Now, I take each one of those categories and put a body in there. But the juggling of the bodies and these things, these traditions, are what I call quadrophenia. And I say that is what you have to look at, that you are, that's describing you. You're communist and collective on the pension fund level. You're a fascist about what TV shows you want or what you want in your neighborhood, what technologies. And then you have the God self, so your monarchism, in your Marxism, and the Marxism is not communist. Marxism is the discarnate astral state that everybody's in, the super angel state. And then you're an anarchist because nobody can control what you do in how you handle your consumer self. And you all have a passion for order within that. You couldn't get a more perfect description of what we all have become than what he did in 1929. Have we talked about that before? Have I thrown this quote at you?
No, I don't think so. You've mentioned that particular quotation before, but we haven't discussed it very much. But, you know, the I think for both of us, the role of tactility and that sort of juggling, quadrophenia, is, you know, a very important, I don't know, question, I guess I would say.
Yeah.
Right? How are we going to get ground without denying the necessity for that kind of juggling?
Yes. And so there was a Wyndham Lewis conference at Bath Spa University outside London in July 2014. So I was in England, so I went to it. And I presented this thesis that, remember, the permissive guy, Spock. Remember in the 50s, 60s, he was the big guide for parents and made them be a little more permissive with their children, not so strict. So Spock was a model that people grabbed onto for conceptual sense of control for many decades, and he was an icon. And then he started to protest against the Vietnam War, and then he got ostracized for that, I think. But I proposed that Lewis, even though he was a great artist and an individualist and an outsider and the enemy of society, he actually updated Spock, that what he says in this quote should be applied to grade 10. People should learn about this, this layout of these four directions in school, so that they get a handle on why it's going to be difficult to have an identity. In the old sense. So I proposed that he was actually the best advisor to families in our time. So the top scholars there, the ones who were longest, they sort of spearheaded the Wyndham Lewis revival, Paul Edwards, Alan Munton, they thought it was very interesting what I said. They liked it because their agenda is to make Lewis be, I guess in an academic sense, the darling of the 21st century and get rid of Joyce. They think Lewis is more important than Joyce. So that's their particular scholarly purpose.
Right.
But
let me just butt in here for a minute. McLuhan had a very interesting take, at least in my perspective, on exactly what you're talking about. So imagine that somebody in grade 10, let's say, is being introduced to this juggling.
Yeah.
Or let's even imagine that there have been hints and suggestions about this coming up in earlier grades. And all that's happening in grade 10 is some sort of synthesis or some sort of emphasis or something on this. McLuhan's question is this going to work? Is this something that can actually be learned like this? Is it something that can actually supply identity? Is it something that would work for the schools? And his answer is no.
Yeah.
It wouldn't work. And why would it not work? And it wouldn't work because the association of what's being taught there in the classroom would still be completely unintegrated with what was going on outside.
Yes.
Which is where the children mostly have their education from. But the predominant factor in their education would be the difference between what they were being taught in their grade 10 classroom and what they were perceiving and feeling outside. So for McLuhan, the only way to get around that problem is to achieve a conceptualization of this juggling that we're talking about that works equally to events outside as inside.
Yeah.
I think that's what Take Today is all about.
Yes.
Today is something that's happening in a business corporation, but it's also something that's happening in the classroom. And the question is, how can both of those areas be conceptualized in a way that allows the study of them, whether in a research lab at the business or in the classroom? How can that study be systematized or conceptualized so that it's the same thing? And if it's once the outside and the inside are brought together like that, then the teaching in grade 10 achieves a ground for the first time. And education can be sort of refounded. And that's sort of what I think McLuhan's central vision was.
Yeah, he would say we're all 4 years old. And so everybody is subject to this reconceptualizing of our perceptual life. So there's no difference between the person in grade 10 and someone in the works for the Trilateral Commission. They're all subject to the same problems.
Correct.
So in light of
But the big thing is, are they subject to the same solutions?
Yeah, that would be...
The idea that we're subject to the same problems is just an acidic sort of acids come nihilism type solution that tends towards a sort of pseudo-Buddhism. Mm-hmm. You know, there are no answers.
Yeah.
And that is the answer sort of thing. So, which is all bullshit.
Yeah.
But for McLuhan, if there is such a thing as understanding media, that can become the way of conceptualizing what happens in the interior landscape and the exterior landscape, in the classroom or in the corporation. And it's what allows the reestablishment of ground, but not through authority, through investigation.
Yeah. Okay, so I think I say this, continuing this co-anesthetic part, I say one becomes the director of the media movie. That's co-anesthetic. While the content is going through an interplay of synergy called synesthesia, the content is doing synesthesia, which would have one identify with the movie or TV show or not. Then I say, perhaps identification with the content became more important. People would only look at content that supported their identity. That's all they had time for. However, their avoidance of the disruption of their identity never worked, because new environments were coming along that they didn't know or anticipate, which would upset them before they had an opportunity to hide. All of a sudden, their teenage son would come home a heroin addict. I can imagine when that started happening in the 80s, what a shock that was for suburban families. Where did that come from? It's like the young man had not obeyed his parents for 5 years. He'd secretly given up being a member of the family at the age of 11. Then...
Right, so the tribe had blown up. Everybody knew it, and the children grew up feeling it.
And coming up with their own solutions, which didn't work.
Absolutely, had to. Yeah. Yeah, and so you have one answer to that is gangs. One answer to that is drugs. One answer to that is hanging out on social media. One answer to that is cliques.
How about one answer to that is to become a fanatic student and do well at Harvard? That won't get you anywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are all different ways of trying to establish identity aside from a general tribalism, you could say.
Yeah.
And the general tribalism, McLuhan could see very clearly, could not be based like the old tribes were, on some kind of authority, some kind of tradition, some kind of that's the way it is.
Even some kind of Big Brother deep state control.
Correct. And the end of the day could not work.
Yeah. So nothing works. That's the beginning of the cul-de-sac, or noticing the cul-de-sac. And then Lewis gives a good overview, generalization of the factors involved and the panic juggling you have to do.
Yes, I don't know enough about Lewis to talk about him.
Okay, so continuing, so then I say the co-anesthetic trend. This trend peaks in Web 2.0 in all the ways documented by a myriad of authors over the last 20 years. But the media analysts missed the decline of the discarnate flood, if they had noticed it at all, into a retrieval, the decline into a retrieval of the triumphant walled-off individual, not so discarnate or merged interrupting aspect in the old McLuhan sense. This set the stage for the popularization of McLuhan's discarnate percept via the cyberspace scenario of William Gibson's Neuromancer, which came out in 1984. Gibson turned the McLuhan discarnate cliche into an art form. Now, this is pretty interesting what I'm trying to get at, that we're past the discarnate. Let's see how I try to say this. Okay. I say, take that, what I just said, but the media analysts missed the decline of the discarnate flood. Then I say, I quote that, then I say, this merged state, merged and interrupting. It was diminished as people celebrated their disconnected intelligence. Derek de Kirchhoff didn't get this in the 90s and wrote a book titled Connected Intelligence. He thought the Internet was connected. It actually was disconnected in effect, as people quickly realized throughout the 90s how rude and stubborn discussion forums were. And everybody lost friends. William Gibson was the first science fiction baby boomer writer who took on the new computer world, producing a novel, Neuromancer, which was a popular bestseller. In it, he coined the term cyberspace, which then became widely used as the Android meme started to get noticed in the 90s with the Internet. Gibson, as a poet, named the new environment what people thought was the new environment, but he actually was describing the old discarnate and super angel state that McLuhan had already spelled out. Gibson had lived in Toronto in the late 60s and was familiar with McLuhan, subsequently a decade later turning the McLuhan theme into an art form. Now, that's pretty unique, eh? Saying, I mean, people just try to find out, luckily, that there's this McLuhan theme of discarnate, and they think they've got McLuhan. But I'm talking about how it was already turned into an art form. That's pretty advanced, if it's valid. The old environment becomes an art form, and everybody thinks it's a new deal. But it's old, right? When something becomes an art form, it is noticed for the first time, and people say, quote, we've got to take care of this. We've got to tidy it up. We've got to decorate it. Unquote. That's how one knows one is in a new environment, when the old environment, being discarnate, which was once a new environment, starts to get noticed and tinkered with, and some people begin worrying, we should outlaw this, like they did with LSD in 66 in the USA, or how they stopped live TV in the early 60s. They created canned TV with laugh tracks. That's TV as an art form. There had been a lot of improvised and spontaneous TV in the 50s. Right. Then,
We're getting up to a time when we should stop.
Yeah.
But let me just say that this paragraph about new environments and old environments and tinkering with them and all that sort of stuff, that's exactly what's going on today with the G20.
Yeah.
Right? It's people looking at what happened a long time ago and trying to figure out dumb ways of dealing with it. It's literally crazy. It's people acting more or less as holograms from 50 years ago.
Yeah. Holeopathic retrievals.
Correct.
Now, I had some words for that. So Everybody is a media ecologist. They're trying to be media ecologists, crude, but they're doing it, and they don't get the post-media ecology situation we're in.
Right.
That's why the, you know, the McLuhan industry, they're really going in the wrong direction, because they would like to get media ecology kind of recognized, what they think is a more sophisticated understanding of McLuhan. But as you just spelled out, it's not relevant anymore. At best, people are already doing it. You don't need to go out there and teach people media ecology. They instinctively are doing it on the executive level in these G7 meetings, trying to do it. And so that's an important point you're making, and it supports what I'm saying, that there's a large part of cliche McLuhan that's obsolete. And obsolete means everybody's doing it with no with no success.
Hypertrophy.
So, well, we did over an hour. That's pretty good, and I think it was important. We're still converging and finding areas of agreement.
Correct. But in terms of your pamphlet, what we have to do, and maybe we can start this way next time, is to get a handle on why you had to go back from the tech body to this, I don't know what you would call it.
Going through history. The stages of apprehension.
Yes. And so the is the idea that the stages of apprehension are going to lead up to the tech body as a kind of orchestrator of perception?
Yeah, as the has taken over the media ecologist role.
Right, right.
And I like Thiel's addition, paramedia. It's a paramedia ecology.
Mm-hmm.
Not post-media, not pre-media, not retrieving feudalism or something. It's paramedia.
Yeah. Yeah, and I like that because it's not historical. It's not diachronic.
Right. So we're at page, I'm making a note. I'm going to email you. We are at page 77, so we will remember exactly where we were. Make an email to myself because we won't be talking for another 2 weeks. But the I think it's correct to go through the stages. I mean, I'm saying things about McLuhan, and you are too, that no one's heard. So we need to, this has to be said. It's like cleaning the Aegean stables. Got to get the old stuff out that hasn't been digested. Or has been shit out, but no one noticed it.
Yeah. So you take the historical way, and what I think we're doing is, I think we're doing an analysis. For my purposes, it would be like people in a lab, and they're testing substances using acids and bases and different kinds of pressure and different kinds of humidity to try and see what's going on. So,
your side of it is you're looking at the chemistry, what you just described. I'm there up with a telescope looking at the psychic weather.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's right. I got the telescope, you got the microscope. I'm pseudo big and you're pseudo small, though neither is a proper category for what
Correct.
We're looking at.
Yeah, but maybe both together work.
Yeah, I think this is pretty good what we're saying here, and nobody else is saying this, right?
Not that I know of.
Yeah, this is should be people should know about this or take it on or get mad about it.
But we can't worry about that. All we can do is try to update the situation as we see it and let fate.
Yes, let evitable fate, not inevitable, evitable fate resolve it. Okay, well, very good, Cameron. Another great talk.
Okay, bye. Talk to you in a couple weeks then.
Yep. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.